I've got Finn McAsey with me. Morning, Finn.
Morning.
We are here to talk permaculture. Finn is a practicing permaculturist and permaculture teacher. 4 weeks ago, we talked to Finn about systems and system theory, which people might be going, you did what? But through the previous interviews we've done, it seemed to be something that was more and more important to understand. Mm. And I sort of jokingly said that we need... we need systems theory because our brains are too small. Basically, it's dealing with complex or complicated things, and I'm not using those words correctly, and that's something you want to clarify. So do you want to go in and talk about those words, complicated versus complex, because this is understanding those words is probably a key to talking about. And then we want some one of the things we thought about after our last conversation was we wanted some real good practical examples.
So what I might do is take a step back in terms of just reminders why we're talking about systems to begin with.
Yes.
So again, you know, in these monthly chats, we kind of focus on permaculture, and systems are quite inherent or intrinsic to permaculture. And, you know, keeping in mind that it's what a 40-year-old kind of practice and I guess philosophy. And from its beginning, there was this understanding of, well, if design, I guess, is kind of a superpower, then if we're not designing, thinking about larger systems, then we're kind of just generally speaking, kind of making it up and trying to do things that look pretty. Whereas if we're thinking of that systems view of life, then we need to consider a much larger whole. We need to take in a lot more perspectives, a lot more features and considerations than we might otherwise do. And if, you know, if we're talking about food production, that's quite relevant. So for example, is if we're thinking about, well, how do we grow food sustainably? Well, we need to think about food systems as ecosystems. And again, all of a sudden we're starting to talk about systems. So I just wanted to take that step back, is systems and systems thinking has been a part of permaculture since its, I guess, inception in 1978. And then all the indigenous thinking and knowledge that has accumulated through the last millennium, of which permaculture draws on, is also based on that kind of systems understanding of life. And so if we're not thinking in systems, we only have access to a very small window or kind of ability to think critically about stuff.
And when you mention agriculture and systems there and ecosystems, I immediately wanted to leap in and go, oh yes, that this is the problem with conventional agriculture, is that it goes, if we got this one thing that we understand about this one thing and what it does to this one plant, and we put them together in the ground, we'll get a result, and you get a result, but then you get a whole bunch of other results you didn't want, maybe down the track, or maybe right away, who knows. And so the point of permaculture is to avoid that.
That's exactly right. And so I think that's a really good place to start, is at least my way of thinking, is why understanding the difference between complicated systems and complex systems is really important, is almost around worldview. So we have inherited this worldview that tells us that the world is like a machine. And we use the machine metaphor to try to understand and describe most things, everything from the human brain to industrial agriculture, etc. And if we're relating to things like a machine, we're assuming that they're complicated. And complicated systems are things that are kind of knowable. You can work out the relationships and the cause and effect between the different elements in it. And so we have this expression in English, you know, it's not rocket science. And rocket science is actually looking at complicated systems. You know, it's looking at what we know about physics, what we know about the predictable things in the universe, and therefore we can actually work out, you know, rocket propulsion, all these things that we can break down into the component parts and understand how they work.
So rocket science is actually easy.
It's complicated. It's way easier than trying to understand the living world. So yes, rocket science is much easier than forest ecology in terms of trying to understand.
That should be a t-shirt, something along those lines. Can we just stop for a second? Can I get you to go and close that window over there?
Because
I just saw it fly back open, and in a minute it's going to slam shut again, and I'd like to keep that glass in one piece. So yeah, super windy downtown, folks. It's probably where you are too today. So rocket science is easy.
Well, I just want to make a connect between yes. That is, again, weather is a complex system.
Mm.
And it's kind of unknowable in the sense that we can't work out all the bits and pieces and then figure out accurately what's going to happen. And yeah. So, a lot of people love to complain about weather forecasting and how it's unreliable and unpredictable and all the rest of it. That's a window into complexity science being applied to the real world. And so you can do your best to try to understand how the world works, but in reality, you actually never know.
And we know with the weather, the closer you get, the shorter the gap between the forecast and the actual time, the more accurate it is as well. So,
yeah.
And that's probably an indication. It indicates something. I actually don't know what.
And so I guess this idea of a complicated system fits very much with that machine worldview. And that a bicycle or an airplane or a rocket are all examples of complicated systems. And so this concept that I don't want to spend too much time on, but is an important one. You brought it up the last time we talked, is around emergence or emergent properties.
Mm.
So both complicated and complex systems have what's called emergent properties. But basically these things that become possible when different relationships form. And in the form of, say we're talking about a bicycle, an emergent property is motion. The tires move, and humans all of a sudden become uber efficient in moving from one place to another just by using kinetic motion. And so, you know, walking and cycling are essentially the same in that we're both using we're using energy kind of stored in our muscles. But you compare the efficiency of the energy we spend walking versus riding a bike, they're not really that comparable. We can spend just a little bit more energy cycling to travel much, much further, much, much faster.
Mm.
And so an emergent property of a bicycle is that movement. Yeah. And, you know, when we look at an emergent property of an airplane is flight. An emergent property of, you know, it doesn't matter what complicated system we're looking at, they have these emergent properties. And often with complicated systems is they're often designed, at least if we're looking at that kind of industrial lens, is we're trying to create these new qualities or features. That's why we design machines.
Yeah, I thought when you said flight's an emergent property of an airplane, my brain's like, well, of course it is.
Yeah.
But that was the plan. But in reality, it is just a bunch of inanimate objects hacked together.
Yeah, that's right. And so when we're looking at complex systems, is those emergent properties, they just happen, and we have much less understanding of them, much less control over them. And it's not to say complicated systems, they also have emergent properties that we don't necessarily design for, plan for, or even understand, but we can work it out. They are knowable. Mm-hmm. We can kind of look back and go, oh, that happened because, and we look at any number of, and I keep using kind of machine metaphors for this, but we look at any number of industrial or transport related disasters, we can usually work out what went wrong.
Afterwards.
But,
yeah.
But with complex systems, we can't do that. Like we can't look at Cyclone Gabrielle and go, oh, that's why that storm was so destructive. You know, we know lots of the different features, or, oh, that's why it became that kind of storm. Or when we look at, an interesting example now is we might be able to look back and start to understand some of the dynamics, but I imagine, and this is getting off track a little bit, but David Seymour's unleashed something now in the public around the role of TTDT and treaty principles in today. And this is one of those things, because politics and societies are complex systems, we can't know. You don't have that same ability to understand those emergent properties. Just things spontaneously arise and emerge.
We certainly, looking back, we can see that seemed possible that he would have an effect that he didn't want to have. But one thing I wanted to bring up was there's this saying that people always have to try to get their heads around the complexity of the weather, which is the idea that a butterfly flaps its wings and China maybe, and a series of events unfold from that leads to a storm in Europe.
Mm.
And but but that's thinking of, but that's not complexity. That's like trying to break it down so our brain can handle it.
But that is complexity. So I guess what it demonstrates about complex systems is that things that happen over here have impacts over there. And there's a non-linear relationship between cause and effect. That is a complex system.
But there's also part of our brain's attempt to simplify something so that we can get our heads around it.
And so this is
because the butterfly didn't really cause it. Like, there were so many other billions of other things. Yeah.
And so I think that is a really important point, is our society treats most things as if they're complicated, where in reality most of the things we're looking at are actually complex. And the issue there is that we have this attitude of, you know, inherited, I think, through kind of enlightenment and Western scientific thinking, that if we analyze and if we do our best to understand the whole system, then somehow that understanding is going to lead to our ability to kind of control and manipulate. And it's not to say we shouldn't try to analyze or do our best to understand the system, but because it's a complex system, it's not knowable. It's not fully knowable. As soon as we think we've understood everything, there's something in the system that changes where there's something new, all these emergent properties. And so we can't use our intellect to kind of quote unquote solve challenges in complex environments. We can try, and we have been forever. Like, I can think of lots of examples, like child poverty. You know, or child hunger. How long have we been trying to solve that one? And mostly because we're relating to it like it's a complicated problem.
Well, we kind of did have it solved. In the 60s, in most Western countries, there was very little. Well, let's say, we know about New Zealand, and there probably were the issues around race there in the mix, but for certainly white New Zealanders, the problem was solved.
And so I think that's an interesting one, is where do you draw your boundary? So again, getting back to talking about systems, is there's this idea of kind of nested holes. And so systems are nested within larger systems, which are nested within larger systems.
So you're going to say in the Western world, we were exploiting the third world for our own benefit.
Going to suggest that if the objective, which was probably never honestly articulated, was let's address child poverty for a small subset of the world's children, then that's a much easier task to put your, you know, you can focus more on that, because then you're able to externalize a whole bunch of children who no longer count. And so
harsh, man.
Yeah, totally.
But you are right. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think, and your point is that at various times we have applied complicated thinking to complex challenges and been able to create short-term or kind of partial quote-unquote solutions.
But we could have just got lucky.
It might have
been because of the huge energy input that oil, fossil fuels, was giving to our economy, that all that was possible. And here I am trying to think of one reason why it happened, whereas we're just discussing the fact that it won't be one reason.
Yeah, but that could be been one of the ones, is all this offset of all of a sudden we have in credit. You know, if we are awash in energy and credit, very challenging issues are much, much easier to solve when you throw a whole bunch of energy and you throw a whole bunch of money at it.
Yeah.
But on the whole, and so now we're at a stage where credit is much harder to come by, energy is increasingly expensive, and we are heading in the opposite direction that I'd say most New Zealanders say we want to, around things like child poverty.
And then our politicians are taking this desire to have a simple solution to its ultimate extreme and saying, oh, it's the problems with the treaty.
Yep.
That's what's causing all your problems out there. And half the country's going, well, we know that that's nonsense, but we also don't actually have a clear idea about why.
And so this goes back to your comment before about, before we started, in the comment you made about our brains aren't big enough. There is something around, you know, we like simple solutions. And politics, or modern politics, I think, have always been about, the soapboxing and the, maybe this is a bit harsh to say, but I think you know what I mean in terms of stereotypically, is what's the one platform that I'm going to get elected on? If I tell people this one thing, then, or if I come with a solution, a prepackaged solution, then people are going to support me because they want that solution.
It was even more simple this time. They just said, we're going to get rid of these things. Yeah. And like with the Three Waters, we're now discovering, well, they've discovered they're in government, and their advisors saying, okay, so you've got rid of plan A, what's plan B?
Yeah.
And they're having to make it up on the spot. It feels like they're making it up on the spot. And they're peculiar to this election more than others, but yeah.
And so there is something around, there's this challenge for us in that we have been taught to think about, you know, even modern science is really primarily reductionistic.
Yes.
And so, which is really about, aligns very much to that complicated system worldview, is if we break things down into their component parts and we isolate things enough, then we'll really understand them. And then when we quote-unquote really understand them, then we can kind of solve or apply that knowledge to solve real-world problems. And, you know, the journey of science over the last couple hundred years is suggesting that that approach is increasingly ineffective.
The more we fix things, the worse it gets.
Yeah. So how do we start thinking in systems? And so I'll take a step back and introduce another type of system as well, which is a chaotic system. And so chaotic systems emerge spontaneously, typically, and they don't last long. So like a house fire is a good example of a chaotic system. You know, a government in some sort of high alert situation responding to an immediate threat of war or a pandemic or whatever, there is this chaotic space. And the system works as hard as it can to eliminate the chaos and to create order. And so it will do what it needs to do in the moment to kind of stabilize.
So you're talking about a cultural political system?
Any kind of system. It doesn't matter.
Okay, yeah. But then in that example, that's what it would have been, yeah.
And so knowing what kind of system we're in is really useful just from a day-to-day perspective, because then we can make choices accordingly. I'm going to behave differently if I'm relating to my house as a complex system, a complicated system, or a chaotic system. And so we'll use the example of a house is if my house is on fire, I'm not going to have a family meeting, right?
To plan for the future, yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to act. I'm going to do whatever I can to put that fire out. Mm. That's what's required, yeah? If I'm relating to my house as a very untidy, cluttered space that needs, that my mental health requires organizing, then I'm going to relate to my house as a complicated system. And it has lots of parts, and the relationships between things matter, and I can organize my house relating to it as a complicated system. Yep.
But you've got kids, so
I have kids. So it might be a complex.
It might be a complex system.
It is a complex system.
Now this is interesting. So
you can see how where I'm going with this, right?
So you're trying to bring complex systems theory into your family dynamics.
Well, it's already there.
What? True. Okay.
It's already there, but it depends on. But I don't, my house, I'm relating to my house at different times in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And so when there is a large storm event and I'm relating to my house in a certain way, there's a storm that I can't control, and I've been in this situation before, living in a tiny house that hasn't been strapped down in very windy storms, that's a chaotic system that I'm trying to stabilize, right?
Yes. Yep.
And it passes really quickly, but in that moment, I'm not interested in a whole bunch of other complexity associated with that system. I'm interested in trying to stabilize the system.
So you're having conversations with your partner where you try to explain to her, honey, the house is a mess. It's a complex system, not a complicated system with our kids.
I think she's an intuitive understanding, and we don't need to go there. Yep, we just kind of go, cool. Tidy time? Yep, it's time to tidy. To organize. Okay. Deep clean? Yep, deep clean.
Deep clean.
Yeah.
We should just do an interview where we give family advice based on complex systems theory, because I guess in one way it does help us like realize that we might be beating our heads against a brick wall on some issues.
Well, and again, that's where I think, and it's not unique to permaculture, but that's why we're having these chats, right? Is how do we make kind of some of this stuff relevant to our day-to-day lives? So we talked about in chaotic systems how the first thing you want to do is you want to act. That's kind of how you behave in that system, is you do whatever you can to stabilize the situation, generally speaking. When we're dealing with complicated systems, we kind of want to take the time to sense and understand what's happening. So if we kind of think the system is complicated, we'll go, so that's for me in using the messy house example, is kind of stepping back and going, okay, there's so much stuff that has a kind of quote-unquote home, and it's not in that place. So I'm taking a moment to step back and analyzing the situation and going, okay, what actions would be appropriate to try to shift the system towards a more desirable state? Yep. And so I can take the time to observe, to analyze, and then to act in a complicated system. And that's typically how you behave. But that's not very effective in a complex system. In a complex system, we need to probe. We need to act into the system in a kind of meaningful way. So we're not picking up the fire extinguisher and dousing the house in a complex system, but we are kind of testing. So we're acting in intentional ways to see what kind of response we get. So we're kind of probing and then sensing the feedback for that and then coming up with a response. And so it's maybe a bit jargony to say it this way, but we have to act into complex systems. We have to see how the system is going to respond.
We have to participate with it.
We have to participate.
Mm.
Yeah. Whereas in a complicated system, we don't really need to participate in the same way. You know, we can spend a whole bunch of time on a computer, on a desktop, or in a lab trying to work out what's happening. In a complex system, we can't. We have to participate in the system.
Mm. But you might not want to sometimes. That could be dangerous.
Absolutely. Yep, that's right.
But you're saying we've got no choice.
Well, we're living beings living embedded in a living world. Yeah, and sure, we've created all these kind of modern conveniences where we can hide away from the world for periods of time, but ultimately there's still a living world out there that we have to participate with.
Because it's trying to get in the building right now.
Mm.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
So that was a big part of what I was wanting to communicate. And then yeah. I think we could look at, you know, we've started to talk about politics a bit. We talked about, you know, social issues like child poverty. I mean, we could talk about economics, we could talk about climate change, we could talk about gardening.
I think I'm always interested in the economics one because of Steve Keen's criticism of economic theory. Mm. And for people that haven't heard of Steve Keen, he describes himself as a renegade economist.
Yeah.
But his criticism is kind of like where astronomy was before the revolution where, I was going to say Gregorian, was it?
Copernican.
Copernican revolution, yeah. So we didn't understand that we were revolving around the sun and the sun was part of a revolving around the middle of a galaxy. And we'd worked out these complicated mathematical systems that actually did explain what was going to happen. They were pretty accurate, but it was still fundamentally wrong.
Yeah.
And he's saying our economics is in that situation at the moment. And he's saying that very harsh comment of economics theories today is they won't take on board the lessons from systems theory.
Yep. And I'd say that's quite accurate. And they're still relating to the world as a complicated system when it's not. I mean, just the fact that there's still supply-demand curve as a core tenet of economics without the recognition there's no such thing as absolute resource limits. Even really simple things like that. When you kind of go, well, but when the last MOA was gone, there was no more MOA. But economics doesn't account for that. No, no, no. But then there's...
Someone will invent a new one.
That's right.
It's probably the kind of the magic hand-waving that goes on.
Well, I think the general theory there is that no, prices will always mean that there'll still be some left. It's just like, but the extinction doesn't... There's lots of things in the world that just don't work that way.
So that curve that you're talking about, like basically that comes down to one person is buying one thing in an economy and there's a curve, you know, comparing price to availability and people's intentions and how much they want to pay. That's such a minuscule part of the economy. One person buying one thing in that moment. And we buy thousands of things over our lifetime and there's millions of us, billions of us.
But it doesn't take into account so many other things that we need to be thinking about when we're dealing with complex systems. It doesn't understand energy. It doesn't understand kind of human wiring around wants and dopamine play and
it assumes things about human psychology, which is that we're all trying to better. We're all only focused on our own wants.
Yeah, well, it does also have that assumption. There is homo economicus, you know, that we're self-interested.
Yes,
And that's inherently, fundamentally, what humans are. So there's lots of things about modern economic theory that I think oversimplifies the way the world actually is. But there's just a whole bunch of things, like it draws a box and says economics sits in this box and anything that's out of the box doesn't exist.
And they call them externalities.
Yeah.
They actually call them that, so we won't consider that.
Well, but the externalities are often things too. Yeah, yeah. So you're right, but there's a whole bunch of externalities that aren't even... that aren't even considered.
You know, there's externalities and then there's invisible things.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so one of the issues, I think, with modern economics is that, again, it is ill-fit for a complex living world. And you have, like, modern inventions on top of that, like modern marketing and the amount of amazing research on human psychology that's gone into manipulating human purchasing behaviors, and all of that plays into both micro and macroeconomics, and that's not really accounted for. There's inequity isn't really accounted for in our modern economic system. Like we're talking about we want to electrify our economy, but we're not thinking of the actual ecological or social impacts of that from people outside of our immediate sphere. I mean, they're horrendous. The ecological impacts of what we're implying by suggesting that we're basically, essentially, I think the best metaphor I can think of is we're not going to smoke anymore because we know smoking's bad, so we're just going to vape now. And I think there's actually a lot of parallels when we're thinking about this whole move to try to electrify our economy, is we're not going to think at all about our relationship to energy use, but we're just going to jump from one power source to another, and somehow that's a solution.
But we know one of the sharp ends of that, which is deep sea mining, seabed mining.
Yeah.
Like in this community, we know about that, but that is, and I saw the movie Deep Rising last week that was on at the old school, and the guy with the money promoting deep sea mining, and I can't remember, just generally, oh no, that's right, in the Pacific, he's saying this is a green solution.
Mm.
This is we're
anytime you hear the word green solution, I'd say,
and he's saving weary. They're saving the world because they're coming up with this green solution.
Yep.
And it is greener than some other things.
Sure.
But yeah.
I'd say complicated thinking, to my mind, is we're not taking in the whole system, and it's hard. But generally, our solutions now are really less bad.
And maybe, I mean, less bad is better than bad, yes.
Totally. Yeah,
but be accurate.
But they still don't, it doesn't mean they don't have intergenerational consequences.
Well, I mean, the consequence, I mean, this is the main reason that seabed mining has been declined repeatedly by the EPA, is because no one understands what the effect is going to be. That it's impossible to prove. There is so little understanding of what happens in the deep sea that it's very easy to show. Ragtag bunch of hippies and concerned communities and the fishing industry can beat seabed mining applications every time.
So this is one of those examples where the understanding of complexity theory and systems science, systems thinking, is ecologically beneficial, because the people who are making decisions within the EPA are going, actually, we understand enough about how living systems work to know that we don't know enough, and by doing this without knowing, the impacts could be disastrous. And so actually we need to demonstrate prudence. We need to not rush ahead or just trust that it's a good idea, but actually accept that there are limits to what we understand. And until we understand the system better, no, we're not going to make rash decisions.
And then one of the side effects of that is that the corporations have got scientists to do research that shows things they want them to show.
Yeah.
And people are watching all this and going, you can't trust scientists.
Yeah.
And scientists are horrified by this, and they're describing the world as being, our culture is becoming anti-science. But what people are really anti is the use of science for those means.
S with a capital, or science with a capital S.
Yeah, but it's very easy to exploit reductionist science in that way, because you can say to a scientist, study that microbe in that place at this time, and then the corporation will extrapolate all the stuff out of it, which most people, even the scientists themselves, are probably not very happy about. In fact, I'm sure they're not. So talk about unintended consequences of that. Distrust of science is now growing out of this.
Well, and I think science kind of does need to grow up, in a sense, in that how does science use what science has learned to develop a new science that does take into account systems and complexity theory at its core.
Yeah.
And so, because science is its own worst enemy in some ways, because, you know, there's still a lot of scientists out there who I would say are practicing science as a 20th century philosophy, you know, not as a 21st century approach to knowledge development.
So everyone who goes, well, probably to school, I was going to say tertiary institutions, but probably everyone should be learning the basics of systems theory, or just the general idea that it's your discussion about complex versus complicated, that a car is a complicated thing, but we can understand what's going on eventually with every part of it. But the real world, the ecosystems, the interrelationships between the 5 million people living in this country, it's all way too complex for anyone, no matter how confidently they speak, to actually know.
And I feel if nothing else, that might develop a sense of humility and compassion, you know, because we are limited in our ability to understand the whole thing. And so might that bring back a sense of awe and wonder about the miracle of life and the beauty of the world that despite all this complexity, it all just kind of still works if we just kind of, you know, leave it alone. And it also allows us to act more humbly into the system, as opposed to, you know, this kind of story we tell ourselves that we're somehow at the pinnacle of creation.
Oh, yeah, the pinnacle of human evolution and cultural evolution, yeah, which some people still believe. It does make it seem really hard to plan for the future, though, because we've got people saying, and you're one saying that there's going to be a decline in the complexity. Oh, there's going to be a decline in Western civilization, and we have to move to some different ways of doing things because we haven't got oil available to us. We've got other people saying, well, we're going to use new technologies we haven't invented to get us out of that hole. They might be right.
They might.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the thing.
Yeah. And there's been a promise of that for the last 100 years, right? Well, so cold fusion is still only 2 decades away.
Now it's getting the discussion about that is getting too complex for us to actually even get an answer out of.
And so, similar to your comment before, is you know, plan A, plan B is we need a realistic plan A, and if plan B emerges, i.e., a new techno fix. Cool. That may or may not be a good thing, but either way, it will allow us to kick the can down the road. But instead of putting all our eggs in the someone surely is going to come up with a technological solution, feels borderline insane to me as a cultural strategy.
Yeah, as a cultural strategy. Someone interesting to talk to would be a military planner, because they're like, we've got a plan. We're about to go to war. This is our plan. We've got it all worked out. We know this is not how the war will go.
Yep.
Yeah, whatever we do, we're going to have to adapt all the time. Yep.
I think from a complexity science point of view is the, what's his name? Sun, ancient Chinese
Sun Tzu,
military.
Sun, what's Sun his Tzu, name?
Maybe, yeah. Yeah. Strategist.
Yeah.
He, I think, has, you know, in some ways, as deep and rich an understanding of complexity as any modern military strategist.
Sun Tzu, yeah.
Yeah.
The Art of War.
The Art of War. And so again, he definitely understood complexity and that idea of how do you approach something that's ultimately unknowable and something that's going to have a whole bunch of constant emergent properties, but still take meaningful action anyway. And that's what we need, I think, is the ability to keep taking action into an unknowable system with a degree of confidence that we, you know, not arrogance, but confidence that we can meaningfully engage with and participate in a living system.
All right, time for us to wrap up. Thank you for coming in, Finn, and I hope we've helped people know that they should go immediately and study systems theory.
Well, we'll be unpacking from here permaculture principles, each of which look at different ways of thinking about meaningfully interacting and working with systems, complex systems.
Yeah. All right, Finn, thanks for coming in. Okay, folks, that is the end of the show for the day. I'm going to be back again tomorrow morning. And I've got a few little interviews left over. Well, I was going to play them this morning, but I ran out of time. Just people I interviewed when we had our station set up at Maui Dolphin Day. So I might play some of them tomorrow morning, as well as an interview with Ngaro Noa.